link to your cover story, Can Democracy Survive the Pandemic? And I want to thank Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold joining us from Denver. And that does it for our broadcast. The amazing Democracy Now! Team is working with as few people as possible on site, the majority of our team working from home. Special thanks to our general manager, Julie Crosby. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. Special thanks to Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the pandemic, featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round, located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop. KBOO is hiring a data coordinator. Our data coordinator supports KBOO's fundraising activities by organizing donor information, tabulating contributions and campaign totals, and maintains KBOO's database. Experience working with DonorPerfect or similar data management platforms preferred. The deadline to apply is Thursday, May 14th, 2020. For a full job description and more information on how to apply, see our website at kboo.fm/employment. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the state has ruled that 31 of Oregon's 36 counties can begin Phase 1 reopening. The state's unemployment rate continues to rise, and applicants still face lengthy waits for benefits. And in national news, Dr. Rick Bright testified to Congress that the administration ignored the coronavirus threat. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 15th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. State officials have given 31 of Oregon's 36 counties permission to begin the slow process of reopening under Governor Brown's Phase 1 guidelines. But due to an increasing number of hospitalizations in the Salem area, Marion and Polk counties were refused permission. In Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas, the three counties that make up the Portland metro area, have not even applied yet. Effective today, bars, restaurants, personal service businesses, and retail stores will begin the slow process of resuming more typical operations in the counties given the green light. In addition, social gatherings of up to 25 people will now be permitted. Businesses allowed to reopen will be required to implement strict social distancing and adhere to a number of other strict measures. Retail stores are required to set a customer limit, have their employees wear masks, and frequently clean high-traffic areas. Stores also have the option to require that customers wear masks, but that has not been mandated by the state. Bars and restaurants must close by 10 p.m., and bar seating will be prohibited. Businesses such as salons can operate by appointment only and must ask if customers have experienced any symptoms and keep a log of all customers in case contact tracing is required at some point. In a memo to county officials, the governor said, quote, "I want to be clear that reopening does not come without risks. She went on to say that health officials may reimpose restrictions on counties that see an increase in hospitalization of infections. Counties that go 3 weeks under phase one restrictions without an uptick in cases or hospital usage will become eligible to move to phase two, although the rules governing that phase have not yet been finalized. But for Portlanders, almost nothing has changed. And the three counties that comprise the metro area remain under Brown's March 23rd stay home order. In a statement, the governor said, quote, "We are asking folks in the metro area to be thoughtful of their fellow Oregonians and stay home and limit their travel to essential need," end quote. But despite the apparent restrictions of the metro area, standalone retail stores statewide, including in Portland, have been given permission to reopen under the Phase 1 guideline. At this point, however, it is unclear how many in Portland will feel safe to do so. During a Thursday morning press briefing, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kefouri pointed out that the county has 27% of Oregon's COVID-19 cases and 40% of its deaths. She gave no indication of when the county will be ready to apply for Phase 1 reopening. An additional 14,000 Oregonians filed for unemployment benefits this week. That brings the statewide total to just under 400,000, who are among the 36 million Americans who have made claims since the coronavirus pandemic just over 2 months ago. But despite the fact that the number of new claims has been declining over the last few weeks, many applicants have still not received benefits. Some have waited weeks without payments, while others claim to have received only partial payments. Others have given up entirely. According to the Oregon Employment Department, about 86% of claims have been processed, but that means that 50,000 people are still waiting. In a release yesterday, the OED, recognized the issue, saying, quote, "Tens of thousands of unemployment claims remain unprocessed, and some have been waiting for benefits for 6 or 7 weeks. The Employment Department recognizes the importance to getting benefits to everyone who needs them," end quote. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the department has had difficulty keeping up with the filings due to an aging computer system that has been long overdue for an upgrade. Prior to the start of the coronavirus pandemic, Oregon had some of the lowest food stamp numbers the state had ever seen. Not anymore. According to a story in Thursday's Oregonian, the number of Oregonians applying for food stamps has increased over 4,000% since the start of the health emergency. Prior to the pandemic, about 1,300 residents a month had filed applications for food stamps through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. The number was low enough that new applicants could be interviewed within a day or two and begin receiving benefits. During its recent peak, there was as many as 13,000 applications a week, and new applicants sometimes waited as long as 10 to 12 days before their case could be reviewed and a SNAP card could be issued. In recent weeks, the number of new enrollees have begun to taper off. Individuals and families needing help can now receive a food assistance card in about 4 days. The mass layoffs associated with the coronavirus pandemic has put tremendous pressure on all of Oregon's safety net programs. Unemployment, Medicaid, and food stamp applications have skyrocketed at rates never before seen and to unheard of levels. The state has seen an infusion of federal funding for unemployment and Medicaid, but officials are concerned that it is not enough, and if the pandemic grinds on, a budget crisis may be on the horizon. Today is Endangered Species Day, but many are concerned that funding to protect endangered species is inadequate. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Organizations are putting a spotlight on species on the brink today for Endangered Species Day. The celebration was created by Congress in 2006. Jeannie Dodds with the Endangered Species Coalition says the Endangered Species Act played an important role in protecting plants, animals, and insects. She says the law has been 99% effective at protecting species that are listed, including two success stories in Oregon, the brown pelican and bald eagle. But she notes that the law has been chronically underfunded.
Increasing funding for the act and providing the reinforcement that it needs in order for actions to be taken at the state and federal level to support species is really the biggest way to ensure that the act continues to remain effective.
Dodd says it's also important to support threatened and endangered species covered by the law with proactive measures, like habitat restoration and protective wildlife corridors. Dodd says in Oregon, big threats to species include land use changes that result in habitat loss, which can upset a delicate balance. For instance, two endangered butterfly species listed in Oregon use two plants as hosts that are also endangered. She says that's the case for the 73 remaining southern resident orcas and Chinook salmon as well.
The species are often closely connected. When one becomes threatened and endangered, then the other is impacted as well. And I see that a lot across the state of Oregon and, of course, elsewhere in the U.S.
Because of COVID-19, most Endangered Species Day celebrations are virtual this year. They include online film screenings and a digital parade. Dodd says her group also is hosting a species identification challenge on Saturday to encourage people to get out into their own backyards.
The idea there is really that once you have a relationship with your local environment and develop that, then it can support thinking bigger picture about other species around you.
In Oregon, folks can visit murals of endangered species in Portland and Creswell to mark Endangered Species Day. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedhoff.
A Salem salon owner said that she is at risk for $14,000 in fines by opening her business too soon. Lindsay Graham, owner of the Glamour Salon in downtown Salem, said that she was warned by OSHA officials on May 4th that reopening while Governor Brown's stay-home order was in effect could result in fines. She reopened her business the following day and let a man inside to the cheers of a crowd of supporters who had gathered on the sidewalk. Graham said she knew that reopening violated the stay-home order, but she needed to provide for her family. Since she reopened, dozens of people have continued to gather to show their support. Graham said that she has 3 days to close or she will face additional fines, but that she was planning to fight the citation. Graham also said that she was questioned by Child Protective Services on May 7th and that they questioned her and her husband and searched her home. Governor Brown was said to be aware that the salon was open in violations of her order and reportedly called the reopening irresponsible and unfortunate. Failure to obey the order is a Class C misdemeanor that can result in a penalty of 30 days in jail and a fine of up to $1,250. And willful violations of OSHA rules carries a minimum fine of $8,900. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two special in-depth interviews where I speak with Secretary of State candidates Mark Haas and Jamie McLeod Skinner. At 6, we'll hear Rising Up with Sonali, and at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect clouds overnight with temperatures dipping into the mid-40s. Tomorrow, we can expect periods of rain with temperatures reaching the mid-60s. On this date in 1886, American poet Emily Dickinson died in Amherst, Massachusetts, where she had lived in seclusion for the last 24 years. The quote of the day is from Emily Dickinson, who said, quote, "If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain." Yesterday, a federal appeals court revived a lawsuit accusing President Trump of profiting from the presidency through his luxury hotel in Washington, D.C. According to the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, federal officeholders cannot profit or, quote, accept any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind from any king, prince, or foreign state, end quote. The lawsuit was brought almost 3 years ago by the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia. At that time, U.S. District Judge Peter Macit allowed the suit to proceed, but his ruling was overturned by a three-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit Court. But yesterday, the full court voted to allow the lawsuit to continue, voting that the three-judge panel had overstepped its authority. The vote was 9-6. The six judges who voted against were all Republican appointees, three of whom were appointed by Trump. Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch and District Attorney General Carl Racine said they hope the ruling will allow them to obtain financial records showing how much foreign governments have paid the Trump Organization to stay at Trump International Hotel and hold events there. The hotel is just blocks away from the White House and is frequented by lobbyists and foreign officials looking to curry favor with the president. The Department of Justice immediately announced that they will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. Dr. Rick Bright, former head of the Federal Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, testified on the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this report.
In riveting testimony yesterday, ousted federal vaccine expert Dr. Rick Bright told lawmakers that the Trump administration had failed to prepare for the COVID-19 outbreak and has been actively misleading Americans on its response. He is the first public health official to publicly refute the president's claim that the administration has done, quote, a great job. Bright was removed as the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority after he opposed political pressure to promote a malaria drug. He filed a whistleblower complaint that was deemed credible, which prompted yesterday's hearing.
I believe Americans need to be told the truth. People were not as prepared as they could have been and should have been.
He said the administration and others were uninterested in his warnings.
I was met with indifference, saying they were either too busy, they didn't have a plan, they didn't know who was responsible for procuring those. In some cases, they had a sick child and it would get back to it later in the week. A number of excuses, but never any action.
And he described a conversation with a Texas-based manufacturer of masks who gave him this dire warning.
We're in deep shit. The world is. And we need to act. And I pushed that forward to the highest levels I could in HHS and got no response.
Trump dismissed Bright's comments this way with reporters on the White House lawn.
To me, he's nothing more than a really disgruntled, unhappy person.
Then later in a tweet storm, he said, quote, I don't know the so-called whistleblower Rick Bright. Never met him or even heard of him. But to me, he is a disgruntled employee, not liked or respected by people I spoke to, and who, with his attitude, should no longer be working for our government. End quote. But many see his claim that he did not know the man is yet another example of his disinterest in responding to the viral emergency. In his testimony, Dr. Bright indicated that he thinks there is still time to respond.
I believe with proper leadership and collaboration across government, with the best science leading the way, we can devise a comprehensive strategy. The time is running out because the virus is still spreading everywhere.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
As a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. House of Representatives is considering changing a congressional rule that has been in place since 1789. The rule requires that lawmakers must be present to cast their vote, saying, quote, no member shall vote on any questions in any case where he was not present when the question was put, end quote. The new rule would allow House members to question witnesses at hearings, sign subpoenas, or vote on legislation remotely. The new rules would allow members to vote remotely by providing precise, binding direction to a proxy who would vote in their stead on the House floor. Once the system is certified, they would be able to cast their votes from home via a secure online portal or a video conferencing system. Democrats state the change would be temporary and would be reversed as soon as the pandemic is over. They pointed out that a number of legislative bodies around the world, including the British Parliament, have adopted the same process. Most Republicans, however, are opposed to the rule change and accuse Democrats of a power grab. Constitutional scholars and parliamentary experts don't foresee a legal challenge because the courts generally don't question how Congress sets its own rules, but all agree that eliminating the need for face-to-face discussion may change the way Congress works in unexpected ways. Daniel Schumann, policy director of Demand Progress, worries that remote sessions will reduce government accountability and transparency and tend to further consolidate power in the hands of the majority. He said, quote, who controls the mute button? Who controls where the camera is positioned? Do you give more power to the committee chair at the expense of committee members? That is a problem. 14 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed, and the Rosebud Sioux tribe in South Dakota is now on lockdown. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota is on lockdown through Sunday after 14 positive cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed on the reservation. The tribe setting up a quarantine facility, which is expected to be ready on Friday. President Rodney Bordeaux informed the community about the tribe's plan in a video message this week with Indian Health Service representatives.
This thing is really spreading, and we really need the cooperation of the public out there.
The tribe's asking people to stay home, wear masks in public, and practice social distancing. The Indian Health Service is expanding testing. The tribe's also setting up a number of road checkpoints. The House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples of the United States is hosting a roundtable Friday with leaders of Native organizations to talk about tribal COVID-19 funding and unmet tribal needs. Topics include the recently introduced HEROES Act, which would provide funding for tribal governments and tribal organizations, and the implementation of the $8 billion for tribes in the CARES Act. Participants are U.S. lawmakers and directors of the National Congress of American Indians, the Native American Finance Officers Association, and the National Council of Urban Indian Health. The Star Tribune reports the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled Wednesday the state's Natural Resources Department had the authority to rename Lake Calhoun to its Dakota name, Bidet-Makoska. The name of the popular Minneapolis lake was changed in 2018. The group Save Lake Calhoun sued to undo the name change. Members of the Native community are supporters of its Dakota name, saying it acknowledges Indigenous people. North Dakota's June primary will be vote-by-mail only out of safety concerns created by the COVID-19 pandemic. Native vote advocates and the state's Indian Affairs Commission are working to address concerns over the Native vote, as Mike Moen reports.
Nicole Donaghy is executive director of the group North Dakota Native Vote. She says they're working to help those who live on reservations with any access issues. She says a big concern is the limited number of drop boxes for people to put their ballots in to be mailed out.
For most counties that do have a reservation within their borders, they are only holding or opening one ballot drop box. And so that could be problematic for people.
She says in some cases, someone might have to drive 30 miles to the nearest drop box. And she says, depending on the size of the ballot, the postage might be too expensive for tribal members with very little money. The new concerns about access come after the state and certain tribes reached a settlement earlier this year over enforcement of a voter ID law. But the head of the state Indian Affairs Commission says the state is making a lot of progress in helping with access issues. Scott Davis heads that commission. He says they've had constant communication with tribal leaders and the county governments about ensuring voting access for those who live on reservations. Davis says that includes the work they were doing even before the recent settlement on the voter ID law.
We worked very well with tribal leaders and their administrations on areas that need remapping.
Those mapping efforts are designed to help Native Americans show where they live, something that wasn't easy for many to do when trying to become eligible to vote under the law. He says they're also working with the Transportation Department on providing ID machines to each reservation ahead of the June primary. Donaghy says she hopes any access issues don't result in a major drop in turnout after they saw higher participation among Native American voters in the 2018 midterm election.
I'm just concerned that voter turnout will be limited because of the pandemic.
Her group has a section of its website dedicated to helping tribal members obtain key information about voting by mail this spring.
That was Mike Moen, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
South Carolina is the latest state to allow residents to vote absentee with an excuse for its next set of elections, but there are still six states where COVID-19 is not a valid reason to request a mail ballot. For more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
If you want an absentee ballot because you don't want to leave your house because of COVID-19, you can get it.
That's the case in 44 states plus D.C., but Missouri is one of just six remaining where COVID-19 is not yet a valid reason to request an absentee ballot. St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum says bipartisan county clerks want that to change before their August elections.
It does not really have the critical mass in the legislature. I think Trump's rhetoric about mail-in voting being like a fraudulent scam is probably seeping into either legislators or Republican voters. I don't think that's helpful.
South Carolina is the latest state to make it easier to vote absentee, notes Jack Noland from anti-corruption nonprofit Represent Us.
The state legislature in South Carolina unanimously came together and agreed that it made sense for South Carolinians to have the opportunity to vote by mail in the June primary and any runoffs that ensue from there.
Anti-Trump group Republicans for the Rule of Law launched an ad campaign this week urging Republican senators in 10 states, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, to pass legislation funding absentee voting and other election safeguards. But McConnell says more relief isn't warranted for elections or anything else. Though House Democrats have proposed $3.6 billion for voting costs in a larger coronavirus stimulus package. Before the pandemic, some states were already increasing ways to vote beyond just in person on Election Day. Pennsylvania's recent allowance of no-excuse absentee voting has been helpful, according to Chris DeLuzio from University of Pittsburgh's Cyber Institute.
We were somewhat more ready than other places to make the shift as voters more and more are expected to vote via mail rather than coming into polling places.
In Pennsylvania, a key swing state that President Donald Trump visited yesterday, Republican strategists told the New York Times they hope resentment of the Democratic governor's stay-at-home orders will boost turnout for Trump in November. Conservative group Judicial Watch Inc. is seeking a court order to compel Pennsylvania state and several counties to purge their voter rolls. They claim tens of thousands of registered voters in the Philadelphia area are deceased. Eileen Olmsted from Pennsylvania's League of Women Voters says cleaning up the voter rolls is a common practice. Counties routinely remove people who've died, changed residence, or didn't show up to vote for a certain number of cycles.
That's a little bit tricky and has been challenged in court in different states, based on that you can't really say why people haven't voted, and the fact that they haven't voted in one cycle or two cycles doesn't mean they're not going to vote for in the future.
But this particular data is unverified. That's why the League of Women Voters and Common Cause of Pennsylvania this week joined against the Judicial Watch lawsuit.
And we don't want people to be taken off the rolls for some frivolous reason.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
NASA satellites are helping scientists to study climate change. With more on the story, here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with today's edition of Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For much of human history, it's been hard for scientists to learn about remote areas of the Earth that they cannot observe directly. Jack Kay is Associate Director for Research in NASA's Earth Science Division.
It's very hard to know what's going on out in the middle of the ocean or on polar ice sheets or in tropical forests or boreal forests.
But modern technology has changed that. NASA now operates a fleet of satellites that orbit the Earth. They make it possible to see the whole planet and observe how it's changing as the climate warms. Satellites can help measure ocean temperatures, sea levels, and forest cover on a global scale and monitor changes over time.
We can see the way that we are changing the surface of our planet. We can look at things like the changing of the mass of the ice sheets in Greenland and tell people, we're really seeing this. We know what's going on.
Kay says along with rigorous data, satellites provide images that help people realize what's at stake as the climate warms.
You can see the Earth sort of suspended in the darkness of space, and the imagery, I think, gives us a clear sense of this is our planet, and this is where we live, and we have to manage it.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 15th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our wonderful remote producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell. Thanks, Ray. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bulkey, and Eric Tegadoff. Extra special thanks to our tireless engineer, Otto. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kabu.fm/give, or you can use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for a special edition of News in Depth, where I will be speaking with two Secretary of State candidates in the Democratic primary, Mark Haas and Jamie McLeod Skinner. Stay with us.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Before you cast your ballot for the May 19th election, learn more about your Democratic Secretary of State candidates. Today, we'll be speaking with candidates Jamie McLeod Skinner and Mark Haas. Check our website if you missed yesterday's interview with State Senator Shamia Fagan. Mark Haas is an Oregon State Senator from District 14 in Washington County. Before public service, he worked as a journalist for many years. Haas is known for being a tax expert in the state Senate and was the architect of the recently passed Student Success Act, which establishes a corporate activity tax to fund K-12 education. Let's listen. To get started, last time you spoke with the KABU News was back in January, when the Secretary of State race and Oregon more generally was very different. Since the onset of COVID-19, has your approach to the race or your policy ideas, changed at all?
Well, the policy goals are still the same. I still have a 90-day agenda of things we have to do to overhaul the Secretary of State's office and add some innovations. I think if there's one thing on that list that has changed, it is that my first order of business had been the Student Success Act, because it was so complex, and I would make my first audit instead of that, and that's still being an important one, but the first one has to be on the state's level of preparedness in an emergency.